Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Otherlog, Radio Vampire, and editor Susan Reed, Father Nalbach here. Join us beyond.
Hey, Autumn, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Sebastian. How are you doing?
I'm good. So everyone, just so you know, this is Autumn from Dark Garden Corsetry, and she has been a major fashion designer in the alternative world with corsetry and designs for many, many years. And we met in Venice Carnival back in 2012. So I wanted to bring you on and talk about fashion and what people can wear for New Orleans for Halloween.
Fantastic. I'm delighted to talk about that. I definitely have opinions.
Okay. So what is your vision of a vampire ball for Halloween? For design and fashion?
A little bit like my own company, which, the name being Dark Garden, I came up with that name because I was looking for something that is kind of mysterious and romantic and a little bit, dark. Mm-hmm. So I think the same sort of guidelines apply for a vampire ball, especially in New Orleans. And if we're going to talk about, line or shape, I think that's important for ladies. Nipped waists are always something that I really like. Fit and flare skirts, a little mermaid action never hurts. I can't wait to see what the gentlemen decide to wear. Because we always focus on women, but. Mm-hmm.
You do stuff for men?
We do, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's not forget men. Men always get the short end of the fashion stick. And okay. I really enjoy designing for men, giving them something that's also interesting and expresses their own personalities and helps them really enjoy the event, helps them feel good about themselves and how they're looking. Because everyone wants to look and feel great when they're at a special event like this.
So in New Orleans, we have three levels of dress code. It's technically four. The first level is zero, which is you're not getting in. And that's, that's...
It delights me that happened.
We've got our inspiration originally from the Anne Rice Memnock Ball that happened in 1995. Did you ever hear of that event?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
that was
talk about it, please. Was
okay.
It amazing?
It was fantastic. So in 1995, I was at the Dark Shadows Festival in the Marriott Marquis, and I met a girl named, I just call her Wednesday, but her real name is Sandra, and she got a pair of fangs for me. And she was like, I want you to come to the Anne Rice Memnock Ball with me. And I'm like, wow, really? And I was playing Vampire the Masquerade for many years, which was like a serious costume contest because, you got to play different clans of vampires from the Toreador, who are the artists, to the Tremere, which are the sorcerers, to the Bruja, which are the warriors and bikers. And each clan has kind of its own aesthetic. And they just came out with 5th edition Vampire Masquerade recently. But I was playing Vampire for 3 years, from 1991 to 1994, and I was hanging out at the Limelight, and it was like a dream come true to go to New Orleans to go to the Memnock Ball. So I went nuts spending money and trying to find a person to make my costume. Sandra was like, we're going to New Orleans. And I spent like 6 months because back then you could only get an access to this ball if you were a member of the Anne Rice Vampire Lestat fan club. And Geffen Pictures actually created a an entire event for the Anne Rice fan club. So mm-hmm. what happened was I was begging and begging and begging and begging all these fashion designers to make me stuff. And I finally got someone to make me a really beautiful velvet coat. And I didn't realize mm-hmm. how horrible it was going to be in New Orleans because, you know, how hot it is down there. And
hot
so,
and humid.
And that was my first vampire ball I ever went to. And it kind of ruined me for the rest of my life because it was like no event that I've been to since has been comparable. And when I got to New Orleans, I got in my car and I drove down to the Coops to get Alligator, and which is down on Decatur, at the other end of Decatur, opposite of the House of Blues. And I just saw all these people walking around in goths, and New Orleans was before Katrina. Vampire scene was underground, and I was like ready to go. And what happened was, I got my costume on, I tried it on, and I didn't realize the heat. Oh my God. And so when Sandra, it was Friday night, and there was like people were renting mansions in New Orleans, so you can go all these private parties on Wednesday and Thursday. And then on Saturday, there was all these after parties. And on Sunday, there was these after parties. And the Anne Rice fan club does their party the Friday night of Halloween weekend. And they're still doing it. So we got to the Anne Rice. I think the party opened at like 7 o'clock. It was at St. Elizabeth's Orphanage in the Garden District, like two or three blocks from Anne Rice's house. And we got our costumes on. And Sandra was wearing a Victorian dress. And there was like 6,000 people outside the gates of the cathedral, outside the gates of the orphanage. And suddenly a horse-drawn carriage comes up and these pallbearers that look like kind of like, you know, something out of Lurch from the Addams Family came out and they mm-hmm. pulled this coffin out and they propped it up and they opened it up and they propped it up to one of the pillars that was at the front gates. And Anne Rice came out and at the coffin. And the whole crowd went insane. This is one of the biggest, best memories of my vampiric experience. And everybody went nuts. And the audience just cheered and went crazy. And the costumes, I have never seen so many incredible costumes in my life. You know, the only balls that compare are in Venice or the Gala Nocturna or the Edwardian Ball. Or the like, and
so you were super inspired by this event.
Yes.
And you're applying to your own event in which ways?
It set a standard for what I want to achieve. I'd like to run mm-hmm. more parties than kind of just like galas. And you know, I see this event was like a gala. But check this out. Right after Anne Rice came out, then another coffin came out. And the coffin was propped up at the other pillar, and out came Kirsten Dunst. And
got
the
it.
Audience went nuts again. And then as you walk in, they both sat in a carriage, and they greeted 6,000 people over a two-hour period from 7 to 9 o'clock as people walked in. And then you mm-hmm. walked through into the place with their doll collection, and they had Victorian dancing. And it blew my mind. It set a standard. But I mean, they had $500,000 to produce this event because Geffen Pictures paid for it, and it was the year right after Interview with the Vampire came out with Kirsten Dunst and Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt and Antonio Banderas. So
right.
this event set the standard, and when I found your company, I was like, wow, this is on the level that I'm talking about. So we set your standard, and I know Daniel, your partner, is one of the best dressed men I've ever met in my life.
Thank goodness.
And yeah, I don't know what I've never met a man that can do that. And,
well, I think it's all about really finding your aesthetic okay. and going after it, and only settling for things that really work for you. I think also a lot of guys are a little bit afraid to be creative with silhouettes or are a little bit concerned about having their masculinity questioned. And he doesn't question that. He just wears things that have a line and style that really appeal to him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's got a girl on his arm. What's the question?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really interesting that you talk about like New Orleans being this point of inspiration. And I don't tell many people this, but the name of my company, Dark Garden, actually came from one of Anne Rice's books. And I'm
really
excited. Yeah. I was inspired by The Savage Garden and really wanted to name my company that. But there was, at that time in 1989, another store opened up in San Francisco and they had the name Savage Garden. And literally this was like the month that I was going into business. And I was a little bit crushed, but we worked with it. We're like, okay, not Savage Garden. What are we going to do? And my boyfriend at the time said, hey, how about Dark Garden? And I said, yes. And so here we are, you know, 30 years later. And I have to say, Dark Garden has done me well. There have been times when I thought maybe I wasn't going to really be successful in a broader scope because I have this kind of slightly goth name. But at the end of the day, if a client isn't interested in my work because of the name, they're not my client, right? So anytime you're dressing for...
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Does the gothic name, do you think that limits your reach? Or it doesn't seem to.
I think that people that are meant to be my client find me, and whether they're looking for something with a darker edge or they're looking for something super classic, you know, my work stands for itself. I'm definitely, I still dye my hair black. You know, you can take the girl out of the goth club, but you can't necessarily take the goth out of the girl. So... those influences will always be with me. And the influence of the New Orleans vampire, that's been with me from day one. So I'm really excited to be a part of your event and really excited to show my work in New Orleans. So
you're excited and honored to finally have you be a part of this. And it's been, we're on our 10th year at the House of Blues. And the House of Blues is, I mean, we are packed in the nines because, you know, we're right in the French Quarter and it's a really accessible place. We kind of call it our castle because it's like a fortress right in the middle of the, like, Decatur Street, the first two blocks of Decatur Street. And one of the things is we've grown so big, we've reached capacity. We only have 1,000 tickets now. And we're at the House of Blues until 2020. We've already reserved it, and we're going to have to give instructions to people because this year we're going to have a lot of Lucy's and Mina's, and because our theme is Dracula, the Court of Dracula, and the hoop skirts in the House of Blues are like taking up all the space next to the angel wings and bat wings and costumes. And one of the things that we really want to do is I've referred people to your company for years because you set a standard that is just extraordinary for dark gala balls. And we don't have a lot of those in the U.S. Those are mostly things like Gala Nocturna or the Venetian balls. And you coming on board is helping us raise the bar.
Well, I'm happy to do so. Definitely. Quality is important to me, and I love helping people find their own style. The thing that drives me always is helping people really love how they look in their clothes, and I like to co-create garments with people, design what is going to best get across the feeling of the event that they are being part of. And it makes me happy. It really is great to work with clients individually, one-on-one. so that we can make them something truly unique that really expresses themselves and brings up, you know, when somebody feels really good in their clothes, you can tell, and it brings up the energy around them. So
design,
there
you
have
know,
it.
It's interesting because the guests of Endless Night are not all goths, but they go for the dark aesthetic. And, you know, 97% of our guests that are ticket buyers, because we do give a lot of local tickets, you know, we invite a lot of locals to the event, but everybody's working because it's Halloween. So, you know, there's one of the big weekends a year where these locals can get their local performers and bartenders get their business is that time of year. So we have, you know, one of the things about Endless Night is we bring people to New Orleans. We start in LA and go to Tampa and Germany and Europe. And we go all over New York and Dallas. We just had our weekend in Dallas. And what's really incredible is we bring awareness to New Orleans as an event, but we try to set the highest standard possible for dress code. And we're going to be really strict this year. So do you mind if I give you a rundown on how our dress code works?
Please do.
Okay. So level zero, there's four levels. Level zero is you're not getting in. That's like T-shirts, jeans, flannel shirts. We want to really set a standard of a Victorian, Baroque costume event. You know, Endless Night is mainly Victorian.
So you're looking for...
What's that?
I was going to say, so you're looking for something kind of timeless, definitely influenced by the past. You want to feel when you're at Endless Night that you are not still in 2018. You don't want to feel like you just rolled in off Bourbon Street or something. You're really arriving to a place that is outside of time and place.
Absolutely. And making it clear what not to wear is our level zero. level one is a basic black costume with a mask, and that allows people to fit in their first year. And it's just, you know, fangs, contacts, black, and a mask. All black is like, you know, a really simple and easy accessible way for everybody to be participating. You know, get a black suit or a black cocktail dress and you fit in really well. And that's the easy, simple option that people have.
Right. Step one.
That's level one. Level two is kind of like a motif, such as a Victorian or an Edwardian or steampunk. We discourage the use of superhero costumes because a lot of people think the New Orleans event is a costume event. It is, but it's based around the Victorian time.
But it's not a Halloween party.
It is.
It might be at Halloween time, but it's not. As you said, you're not looking for superhero costumes. And, you know, when I say it's not a Halloween party, years ago I felt entirely out of love with Halloween because I've seen too many Halloween costume contests. I've seen the prize go to the naked girl. And it doesn't take any creativity to be naked. It takes creativity to put some effort into your costume to really think about what you want to convey. And, you know, you don't want to, as you said, no superheroes. Like, that's not about you at all. That's about putting on maybe a costume that may have come in a plastic bag. So,
yes. And most people that go to New Orleans get their costumes made years in advance. It's a ritual. And part of, you know, rituals have three phases: the prelude, the working, and then the after. The prelude is everybody getting ready for New Orleans, buying their plane tickets, getting their hotels, getting reading up on the event, and getting their costumes together, and then buying their tickets, and then going to New Orleans, going around, and we have a variety of events that prepare people for Saturday night, and then the after is after the working, but the working is the actual event itself. When the gates open and everybody walks in and you meet people in costume and you go, wow, I met you at the bar the other day or at the pre-party or at the salon on Friday night. and then you know, the gala experience happens. And going level two is something that a lot of more experienced or dedicated people do. And that is, you know, what is, you know, that's like a steampunk costume or a Victorian dress or with a top hat. But most people have their stuff custom made. That's why Dark Garden Corsetry is such a good inspiration for people and a good resource to be a part of the event, to set an example, because a lot of people will come the first year and go level one, and then the next year they'll go level two. And then finally, level three is like what you see at the Bal de Doge in Carnival, but a darker version.
Mm-hmm.
And we both are big fans of Carnival, and that's where we actually met. And I think that going to those events is like, I mean, Carnival tops the top, you know, costuming in the
absolutely
world.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely
those
true
are level. What are you going to be wearing?
Well, I've got something in the works, and there's a lot of black jet involved, so black and sparkly, but and I'm keeping it narrow, as you said. Too many hoop skirts in a room makes it a little bit difficult to get around. I'm also, I don't really like wearing wings, you know. I've been to too many events where I've gotten poked in the eye with a wing, and I'm on the petite side. I'm only 5'3". And that makes me kind of elbow height. So when you add elbows and wings in, it's just it's a danger zone. So I'm all about keeping it sleek and, shapely.
Well, sorry?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're one of the best corset designers known to humanity.
You heard it here, folks.
I've known so many people that have obtained your corsets, and now, do you only do custom designs, like for each individual, or do you actually?
No.
We have
ready to wear corsets. Started the business in 1989, and for about the first 8 years or so, I only did custom work. So my feeling was that corsets are so specific, they can only be made to measure. And I was learning a lot. You know, when I started the business, there was no one else making corsetry. And so I didn't have any teachers. I had to learn all of this on my own. And so I worked with individuals. I made a pattern for each person. I did multiple fittings. And through that process, I really learned how people's bodies can be shaped and what people like to wear. And I also developed a really extensive database of client measurements. And from that, I was able to develop a very effective set of ready-to-wear patterns because I was keeping track of how I was reducing people's waists and what was working really well and what kind of shapes worked for the greatest number of people. So we now have about, I would say, like 15 different ready-to-wear styles, and they work for bodies of all types. So because we have all of these different styles, they work for different body types, whether you're sort of an hourglass or if you have more of an up and down figure with, say, wide shoulders and narrow ribs. We've got a corset for that silhouette. But it's always about creating a little more waist than one has naturally. But we're able to fit just about everyone. I think about 15 years ago, we came up with our men's ready-to-wear corset. It might be too much. Maybe it's 10 years ago. But because we have so many male clients as well as women, and men that just want to come in and pick something up, because, boy, I'll tell you, guys don't like to think ahead. So we developed this waist-center style that is specifically designed for men's bodies. It fits like a dream. So many guys come in and just love it, really like how they look in it. And again, because we've been doing this for so long, we really understand what makes a corset comfortable. A lot of people expect corsets to be kind of torture chambers. And bad corsets can be that, but that's not what I make. Feel like a portable hug. And every person I've put into a corset, you know, it totally improves their self-esteem instantly. It's just a true pleasure to witness.
Now,
so
when were
I'm hoping that. Well, the very first waist cinching garments were worn by warriors in Crete in I don't even know what BC, and they came back into fashion in the 16th century.
Okay.
And were consistently part of fashion from the 16th century on through the end of the First World War. And then
oh,
they
wow.
came back. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And
I didn't know that. I thought they ended like around the Edwardian era before World War One.
Well, I mean, women were still wearing them to work during the First World War. For the most part in the 20s, women, like young stylish women, moved away from corsetry. But, you know, a lot of women, like I would say 35 and over, they were still wearing corsets because they were accustomed to that being part of their dressing ritual. So, you know, high fashion, sure, no corsets, but the average mature woman was still wearing some kind of foundation wear. In the 30s, we see these sleek lines and think, oh yeah, no corsets. You know, there's still some serious shapewear happening. And then after the Second World War, Mr. Dior brought in the new look, and part of the new look was a corselet, again, waist nipping. And it wasn't until, I would say, late 50s, early 60s, that really went by the wayside. But to this day, you know, people that like to feel that kind of support, they wear some fantastic underpinning. So
now, are corsets always underneath, because I know that the modern corsets that I see in goth clothes and Renaissance fairs and stuff like that, they're like a bodice
invisible,
type,
right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Was that always the case?
I make corsets, you know, until, I would say until the late 80s, early 90s, when I started my business, and also when Gautier was designing corsetry for Madonna, that's the first time we started seeing corsets visibly on the outside of clothing or as the bodice itself. Mm-hmm. Before then, corsets were always concealed. They were underwear, so it was like, you know, us running around in a corset and a skirt, that's like us running around in our bra.
Oh, wow.
Which
okay.
These days it's completely fine to run around in a bra, but we're wearing
now,
less and less all the time, aren't we?
was corseting a technology, you know, I mean, to be able to have all these measurements and fit someone and whatnot. Can you tell us about what it does to your body? Like, does it really move your organs, or do people really corset train?
People really do corset train. It's only the very most extreme cases that involve displacing organs. For the most part, what waist training is doing is creating a flexibility in the muscles around your waist. And some people are concerned about wearing a corset too often that it's going to atrophy your muscles. And I personally have not found that to be the case. I feel like, of course, it kind of brings me a body awareness and awareness of posture. So I'm still keeping all of my muscles engaged and workable. I just have better posture when I'm in a corset. Waist training is the regular application, the regular wearing of a garment that is gradually reducing the size of your waist. And again, part of that is that it's adding to the flexibility of the muscles in your core, so that they can be pulled in closer to your center. Additionally, it also compresses the tissue a bit.
Are you corset trained?
It's something that I love. I go through phases where I wear corsets daily. My waist reduces quite a bit. I can probably reduce my waist about easily 6 inches from my natural waist.
Whoa. And what about men? Can men corset train?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the most famous of corset trainers is Mr. Pearl, and maybe right up there with him is was Fakir Muzaffar. May he rest in peace.
Oh, yeah, I heard he passed away.
He passed away not so long ago. But he was the first in this century, or I'm sorry, in the last century.
Yeah, right?
First in the 20th century to train his waist. And he really, he absolutely 100% pioneered the modern primitive movement, but part of that was his waist training, and he reduced his waist probably 12 inches. So
now,
very, very extreme. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the sensuality of corsets, because we heard in the 19th century about women wearing corsets to the opera, and they had to go see a doctor to be able to be relieved of they couldn't express themselves. And they would have to go to a doctor to have that, I think it was hysteria, or I forget
hysteria,
the name.
Hysteria, yes. Yeah, I am hysterical. I need help from a doctor. Please, doctor, please apply the vibrator.
Does that still happen today? I mean, does corsets, because I think corsets are very sexy. I mean, it can make a
corsets,
you know,
are very
woman.
Sexy. I think you're kind of conflating two different Victorian, not myths, but things that were going on in the Victorian era. So yes, women were wearing corsets. Yes, they wore them to the opera because you did not leave the house. Ladies didn't leave the house without a corset. Most women of all classes wore some kind of boned fitted undergarment. The term loose women theoretically comes from the idea of a woman not wearing any kind of foundation. So she would be loose as opposed to nice and tight. That being like the foundation that the corset created. But the whole hysteria issue, women were incredibly repressed and not allowed to express themselves, and women weren't good women. Ladies were not really expected to enjoy sex, and orgasms were not spoken about whatsoever. And a married woman, you know, I think it was a rare married lady, I'm going to say, just to divide, because upper class, middle class, lower class, the class system was pretty entrenched in the 19th century. But proper ladies were not expected to enjoy sex. The lie back and think of England idea, you know, do your duty. You know, I could go on and on about the repression. But that's like aside from corsetry, they don't go hand in hand.
Okay.
I think that corsets were fetishized and continue to be, because they create an extreme feminine figure. So the natural feminine figure is slightly hourglass. The extreme feminine figure is definitely hourglass. And, you know, there's genuinely a correlation between a dramatic waist to hip ratio that goes with fertility, and that attracts the what I call the lizard brain, the deep seated the drive to reproduce, or the act that is part of reproduction. You know, you see a lot of guys will see small waist, wide hips in some part of their mind, whether it's a conscious part or not, like they want to get busy because there is a drive within to procreate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
the primal nature, you know,
the primal nature, indeed.
You know, I saw on TV once a class where men and women, the couples, could go and learn how to lace corsets. Is that still going on, or do you know anything about that?
I teach corset lacing lessons on a regular basis. It's a really important part of corset wearing.
Okay.
My friend, did you realize that we've been speaking for 40 minutes?
We have, and we have on this broadcast another 8, actually. I didn't. The program evidently set for 45 minutes. So, do you,
okay.
Do you mind if we go on for another 5 or 6 minutes?
I can give you another 5 minutes.
That'd be great. Because this
you know
corset
what? I'm at a party and I'm in a sound
booth. Oh no!
It's really funny.
Okay, well let's wrap it up then. I'd like to talk about real quick about the finish up with the corsets, and then find out where people can find you and your availability.
Mm-hmm.
Where people want to go and obtain a real corset from you, what do they need to do?
Mm-hmm. Go visit my website, which is darkgarden.com.
Okay. And do they need to see you in person?
They don't. We have our ready-to-wear corsets available on the website for purchase. You can purchase one today, and if we have it in stock, we'll send it off to you immediately. And if it's not in stock, we can make it for you in 4 weeks.
So pretty much today is the deadline.
Just in time for the event. Yes.
Oh, great. And now, for gentlemen who want to help their ladies, do you have instructions on your website on corseting, or do you have videos, or?
Or for lacing? We have a self-lacing? No, we have a lacing video on YouTube. If you search Dark Garden Lacing Video, you will see me lacing someone else. And it's a lovely video. So again, just on YouTube, search Dark Garden Lacing Video. And you'll see me doing what I have done more than any other living human, I believe.
So you are the world's
pretty sure
authority
that
on corseting?
I'm not going to say I'm the world's authority on corseting. I will say, because I'm a rather humble person in many ways, but I will say it is likely that I personally have laced more corsets than any living person.
Well, I look forward to taking a course from you and stuff. Maybe we can talk about that for a future last night. Autumn,
fantastic.
Thank you so
Sounds
much
good.
For joining us.
My pleasure, Sebastian. All right.
And
see you soon.
And darkgarden.com, everyone. Have a great day and rock and roll. This is Father Sebastian with the Obelisk.